The question, as Phyllis said, is how can God be good when religion is responsible for so much injustice in our world? Maybe tonight you're here and this is not just a theoretical one, this is a real one, this is a personal one, because you've met hypocrites. Or maybe you've been hurt and wounded by individuals or institutions which have been acting apparently in the name of God or in the name of a religion. If that's the case this evening, if that's you, I want to say I'm sorry. It's uncalled for. There's no excuses. It's wrong. I'm sorry to say, as a Christian, the words of Gandhi ring true, even when I think of my own life. Gandhi once said, "I like your Christ, but I don't like your Christians. Your Christians are so unlike your Christ." I know that's true of me, as much as anybody else. Now, I come to this topic as someone who grew up in the land of Northern Ireland, a land that's riven by religious division and political violence between two communities, Protestant one, a Catholic one. I grew up surrounded by people who went to church on Sunday, who sang their songs, who prayed their prayers. And then they went out and they planted bombs under cars for people going to work the next morning. Or they planted bombs in busy high streets on Saturday afternoons that were set off. It's madness. It's without excuse. It's without justification. And that it's done in the name of God is absolutely disgraceful. This is a real hard subject for us this evening. There's a lot of ground that we could cover. But before we lift up this stone, before we look at the dirt that's underneath it, would you allow me just to flip the question for a few minutes? Would you allow me just to come at it from a totally different angle? Because I would like to first of all point out to you how Christianity has done a world of good for the cause of justice and goodness in our society in many ways that we often take for granted today. For example, the secular legal philosopher Jürgen Habermas says that our ideals of freedom of conscience, of human rights and democracy, they are the direct legacy of the Judaic ethic of justice and the Christian ethic of love. He goes on and he says, to this day, there is no alternative to it. And so Christianity has a great legacy to be proud of in these ways. Added to that, across the centuries, Christians have been at the forefront of the struggle for justice. You may have heard of some of these people, people like William Booth, who worked with the homeless, who worked with people struggling with drug and alcohol addiction. People like George Mueller, who cared for orphans. Florence Nightingale, who was the pioneer of nursing care for the sick, the wounded, and the dying. William Wilberforce, who campaigned for the abolition of the wicked, evil slave trade. Thomas Barnardo, who established a school and 100 homes for poor children. Lord Shaftesbury, who reformed conditions in factories and in mental health hospitals. These are Christians who have done great good in our society. Take another more recent example, more famous example perhaps, Dr. Martin Luther King, that celebrated civil rights campaigner. Part of his story that isn't often talked about is the fact that he was an ordained Christian minister. He was a preacher. And in his celebrated 1963 speech at the Washington Monument, that huge crowd of people gathered together to call for justice, when he gave his I Have a Dream speech, he said, "Now is the time to make justice a reality for all God's children, from base black to treble white. We're all God's children. Whatever our color of our skin, we're all God's children." He finishes off that speech with a rallying call for radical equality in society, taken from the words of the biblical prophet Amos when he cried out that now is the time for justice to roll down like a mighty river. Now is the time for righteousness to pour down like a mighty stream. Dr. Martin Luther King knew the words of the prophet Isaiah, that the Lord says, "I love justice." And he dedicated his life to fighting for that justice to be realized in American society. You saw the culmination of that great struggle in the election of Barack Obama as president a few years ago. There are many other Christians like Dr. Martin Luther King. Their names are often not known. Their stories are often not retold. But they have taken their stand. They have championed the inherent value and dignity of all people, whatever their race, whatever their gender, whatever their sexuality, whatever their stage of life, from the womb to the tomb. All people are important. All people are valuable in God's sight. These Christian activists, they were inspired by the conviction that all people have been made in the image of God, our Maker. They were inspired by the example of the compassion and the goodness of Jesus Christ in his life and ministry on earth. These Christians have done a great deal for the cause of justice in our world. Nevertheless, that's not the whole story, is it? That's why we've got this question this evening. You see, the religious hall of shame is packed with exhibits that show us the dark and the evil face of religion too. In the name of Islam, September 11, the terrorist attacks in New York and that plane that crashed outside Washington, the atrocities in the Middle East of ISIS, the bombings in London and Barcelona and Paris and Berlin in recent years. In the name of Buddhism, there's been terrible things that we've been reading about in recent weeks. The ethnic cleansing happening in Myanmar against the Rohingya minority. Evil being done in the name of Buddhism. And yes, Christianity too. Evil done in the name of Christianity down through the centuries. Things in the Crusades. Things done in the Inquisitions. As well as the stories of many people in our own day who would testify to feeling condemned and repressed and harassed by Christians. These are sad stories. They're true stories. And based on examples like this, the atheist intellectual Christopher Hitchens wrote a few years ago before he died that religion poisons everything and therefore threatens human survival. His friend and colleague, Professor Richard Dawkins, adds his voice to this. He sets out the case for us being better off if we were to get rid of religion altogether. Dawkins says, imagine with John Lennon, a world with no religion. Imagine no suicide bombers, no 9/11, no crusades, no witch hunts, no gunpowder plot, no Indian partition, no Israeli-Palestinian wars, no Serb-Croat Muslim massacres. As this goes on, no Northern Ireland troubles, no honor killings, no shiny-suited, bouffant-haired televangelists fleecing gullible people out of their money. His list goes on and on and on in his book, The God Delusion. But I wonder, is it really that simple? Is the answer to religion that has gone wrong to get rid of religion altogether? Is the safest course of action for us to all become atheists? Is that the way that we'll find peace and justice in the world? I don't think so. You see, there's another hall of shame. The irreligious hall of shame that's packed with its own exhibits of evil done in the name of atheism. Professor John Lennox responds directly to Richard Dawkins. He says, stop listening to John Lennon and start listening to me, John Lennox. Imagine a world without atheism. A world with no Stalin, no Mao, no Pol Pot. A world with no gulag, no cultural revolution, no killing fields, no concentration camps. Wouldn't that be a world worth dreaming about too? And in his voice to the description of the violence and evil that's been done in the name of atheism comes Oxford professor of religion and science, Alistair McGrath. He says that the 20th century gave rise to one of the greatest and most distressing paradoxes of human history. That the greatest intolerance and violence of that century was practiced by those who believed that religion caused intolerance and violence. It's a sad irony. The atheist professor of ethics, Peter Singer, confesses atheists had committed their fair share of heinous crimes. Putting these threads together, the conclusion is clear. Neither religion nor atheism has a monopoly on the criminal use of violence. Yes, religion does go wrong. The religious hall of shame is packed with examples of it. But so does irreligion, so does atheism. In fact, when you look around and you think about it, anything can go wrong, can be used to perpetuate violence and injustice and cruelty. Money is a cause of injustice, isn't it? In our society, we hear about this often. The rich get richer, the poor get poorer. It's unjust, it's not fair. Football is responsible for its fair share of violence and dispute, isn't it, in our world, in our society? Even science is a wonderful thing. It's brought us many advances, many blessings, much help, and yet science that gave us nuclear power also developed nuclear weapons. Right now, you, like me, perhaps are just watching what is going on in North Korea and what is happening with Donald Trump sending tweets to a guy with nuclear weapons, just trying to provoke him, calling him little rocket man and things at the UN. What is going on? And yet science has brought us both these two things, great power and also great destruction. See, all these examples go to show you that it's not so simple that it's all religion's fault. All these examples show us that human beings are very good at taking anything and abusing it and misusing it to serve their own agendas, to hurt other people. I suggest to you that the root of the problem of injustice, it's not out there in other things, that if we were to leave them alone, we'd be fine. The root of the problem of injustice, it's found very much closer to home. It's within each one of us. It's not that religion poisons everything. It's rather that human beings poison everything, including religion, because our own hearts are poisoned with the principle of sin. We take good things, we misuse them, and we abuse them to serve our own selfish agendas. That's why the atheist Bertrand Russell said that it is in our hearts that evil lies, and it is from our hearts that it must be plucked out. That's why Einstein, writing in 1946 in the New York Times, just months after the destruction of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, said, "The release of atom power has changed everything except our way of thinking. Science has brought forth this danger, but the real problem is in the hearts and the minds of men. It is easier to denature plutonium than to denature the evil spirit of man." What these two people who were not Christians are telling us is that it's not so easy that you can draw a line. These people are good, these people are bad. We need to get rid of them. Rather, the line between good and evil, it runs through all of our hearts. It's a principle within each of us. We're a part of the problem. So the question for us is really, what can be done about our hearts which are tainted and poisoned with evil? And the good news is that's precisely what Jesus Christ has come to do. That's precisely the answer that he brings. What can be done for people whose hearts are divided between good and evil? And the first thing I want to share with you this evening is that Jesus reveals the problem of our hearts. And if you take some time to read the biographies of Jesus, the historical accounts of his life and his ministry called the Gospels, you'll quickly see that the people whom Jesus had the roughest time with, the most run-ins with, were religious people. They were the religious fundamentalists of his own day. And you'll also see how Jesus saved some of his most severe rebukes for these religious Pharisees. In fact, you'll find in Matthew chapter 23 an entire sermon against these religious people. In that sermon, he calls them hypocrites. He later on gives us the textbook definition of a hypocrite. He says, they do not practice what they preach. They say one thing, but they live a total different way. And he even goes on and he illustrates for us what a hypocrite, a religious hypocrite, looks like in graphic terms. He says, you are like whitewashed tombs, which look beautiful on the outside, but on the inside are full of the bones of the dead and everything unclean. In the same way, you Pharisees on the outside, you appear to people as righteous, but on the inside you are full of hypocrisy and wickedness. Jesus doesn't save his punches in these guys. Jesus is harsh with the Pharisees, but it's for a particular reason. You see, the Pharisees are very good at pointing the finger at other people and saying, look how awful that person is. And they forget that they've got three fingers pointing back at them as well, accusing them. You see, the Pharisees have become blinded to the condition of their own hearts by their pride and their self-righteousness. They have lost sight of the fact that it's not just other people who have a problem of evil in their hearts, but they also have it. And Jesus wants to wake the Pharisees up and to show them very powerfully that they need help too. They're not just the healthy people who can help the sick. They themselves are sick. Jesus needs them to see that the problem of sin and evil is far too deep within the frame of our being to be cured by shallow, skin-deep external religious rituals and self-help morality. Jesus wants the Pharisees, wants all of us to see that at the core of the human personality, there is something which is bent out of shape, something which is bent towards selfishness and evil in various guises. All of us need a radical change of heart. Jesus says to the Pharisees on another occasion, it's out of the heart of a person that come all manner of wickedness. We need a radical change of our hearts. We need someone to come and to straighten out our bent hearts. And that's something that only God can do. No amount of religion can do that for you. Only God can straighten out your bent heart. And religion only has value as it points you to that reality, as it puts you in touch with that truth, that there is something radically wrong in me that only God can fix. And what makes Christianity stand out uniquely and alone amongst all the religions, all the philosophies of this world, is that Christianity is not a rule book of all the good things that you need to do to work your way up into God's good books, all the things you need to do to straighten out your own bent heart. That's what all the other religions tell you. It's, here's the ladder, here's how to climb it, to get up into God's good books. But Christianity is really the story of the good God who has come down into this world and has done everything necessary to straighten out our hearts and to bring us back to himself. That is utterly unique in the history of the thought of the world. That is utterly unique in the history of religion. What is on offer in the person of Jesus Christ at the heart of the Christian faith? Jesus reveals the problem of our hearts and the answer to it. The second thing this evening for us to think about is that Jesus reveals the heart of God. One of Jesus' most well-known and famous sermons is called The Story of the Prodigal Son. I like blowing up misconceptions. I have to tell you, it's a misnomer, that title. It's really the story of the two sons, the two brothers. It would even better be called The Story of the Good Father. And the story begins, maybe you know it, the story begins with the first son. He comes to his father and says to him, Dad, I want my inheritance now. That's as good as saying, Dad, I wish you were dead so I could have your stuff right now. I don't want to wait however long it will be until you kick the bucket. That's a huge scandal. That is shocking. In Jewish history at the time, there was another story like this. And what happened was the Jewish father kicked his son out the door and banished him. That was the way of restoring honor to the family. That's not what happens in Jesus' story. This father absorbs the shame and the scandal. Probably at great loss, he converts their assets into cash, probably at a loss. And then he gives his son his half of the family estate. And off goes this worthless, thankless son, off to greener pastures. He's off to go and live the high life in the big town far away. He's off to go and use his money to buy whatever pleasure his heart desires. And while the money lasts, he's got friends aplenty. He is having a great time. But as soon as the money runs out, so do all of his friends and companions. And as lowest point, this Jewish boy finds himself in a pigsty, the most shockingly scandalous, unclean place for a Jewish person to be in the world. A slave of a foreigner. And he decides, you know what, I'm going to go home. Because I'd rather be a slave in my dad's house than here in this foreigner's house in this pigsty. And so off goes this son. He goes on the long journey home. He knows, I've got to face Dad. The day of reckoning is coming. On his way back, he is rehearsing his speech. Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me a servant instead. He comes over the hill and he sees home in the distance. And as he gets closer, he notices a cloud of dust starts to rise. There's someone running towards him. It's Dad. Men in this culture don't run. It's not dignified. It's scandalous to run. If Dad's running, this is bad. Dad is angry. I wonder if he begins to brace himself for the volley of punches and kicks, for the insults that are about to come his way and being told, clear off, get away. You're no son of mine. I wonder if that's what's in his mind. And then shock of all shocks comes when Dad arrives. And it's not punches and kicks that he greets his son with, but rather his open arms. He throws himself around his son, hugs and kisses him. Jesus tells us, but while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him and kissed him. The son said to him, Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. But notice he doesn't get to finish his speech. The father said to his servants, quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and now is found. And so they began to celebrate. Often we finish the story there, but Jesus doesn't finish the story there. Remember, this is not the story of the prodigal son. This is the story of the two brothers, the story of the two prodigal sons, if you like. You see, there is a second son, and he's been a good boy all his life. He's been staying at home, saying he's said his P's and his Q's. He is a good wee boy for his dad. He's been in his father's service all these days while his brother's been away off wasting their estate. And this second son is outraged that his brother is brought back into the family and is welcomed home. He's outraged. It's not fair. He doesn't deserve it. Jesus tells us the older brother became angry and refused to go in. So his father went out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father, look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders. Yet you never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours, who has squandered your property with prostitutes, comes home, you kill the fattened calf for him." The father responds to his angry son, "Son, you have always been with me, and all that is mine is yours. But it's fitting that we would celebrate and be glad, for your brother was dead and is now alive. He was lost and now is found." And that's the end of the story. Jesus, the master storyteller, leaves us hanging on a cliff edge. It's unresolved. What will happen to the son out in the field? His father is standing there saying, "Come into the party." What will happen next? Why doesn't Jesus tell us the end of the story? What will the boy do? But you see, the reason why Jesus won't tell you how the story ends is because Jesus is telling this story to a particular group of people. They were the Pharisees. You see, the Pharisees have been giving Jesus a hard time because Jesus has been spending time with people like the first son, people whom in their eyes were immoral and ungodly and unworthy and sinful. And Jesus welcomes them and treats them as friends. They're not happy with that. It's not fair. They're bad people, Jesus. They're not like us. They've not done all the right things all the time. They've got it wrong. Why do you love them so much? You should be giving them a hard time. Jesus wants the Pharisees to see themselves in the second son. The ones who have their arms crossed, they're standing outside the door and they're saying, "We're not happy about this. It's not fair that you're so kind and generous to these evil, evil people." You see, this story is actually a story of two sons, both of whom are lost. It's obvious to see that the rebellious one, the one who runs away, is lost. It's harder, though, to see the religious one, that he is also lost. Both of these boys, in their own different ways, are alienated from their father. Both of them are in this relationship for what they'll get out of it, their father's stuff, rather than for the love and the joy of the father himself. And Jesus is inviting the Pharisees to come like the sinners and to come and enter the delight and the joy of the Father, to leave behind the duty and drudgery of religion. Jesus wants the Pharisees to know a loving Father in heaven, not a religious slave and taskmaster, which is what the Pharisees have turned God into through their rituals and systems of morality. And the star of the whole story is the Father. He is the absolute star. His incredible, his generous love. It's just a peak of the incredible dimensions of the love of God our Father in heaven towards all of us. And Jesus is God's true Son. He's the one who reveals the heart of the Father. He's the one who has left his home in glory and in heaven, who's come into the far land, to this world, in order to bring home to his Father back in heaven religious sinners and rebellious sinners, people like these two sons. He's come home to bring home the religious runaways. He's come to bring into the party of heaven the religious workaholics. And the good news tonight is whether you are religious or whether you're a rebel, Jesus has come for you. And Jesus is welcoming you to come in and to come home because God loves you, because God wants you. Jesus reveals to us the heart of God. But then thirdly and lastly, Jesus reveals hope for the victims of injustice. Returning to our question, we're thinking about how can God be good whenever religion is responsible for so much injustice? But I want to tell you about the greatest act of injustice, the greatest act of evil that religion has ever done. And it was done against Jesus in its conspiracy to murder him. It was the Pharisees and their supporters in the temple, the Sadducees, leaders of the religious order, who arrested Jesus, who had him slandered in court, who bent the jury of his peers, who exerted undue pressure on the judge to have Jesus condemned to death. It was the Pharisees and their religious lackeys who stood at the cross of Jesus as he bled, as he suffocated, as he suffered excruciating pain and mocked him and laughed at him and taunted him. It might seem strange to say it, but the cross of Jesus is good news for you if you're here and you are the victim of the hurt and the harm and the wickedness of religion. Because the cross of Jesus tells you that Jesus knows what it's like to be a victim of religion. It tells you what he knows what it is like to be violated, mind and body and spirit. Jesus understands your wounds and your pain so well. His body was violated. His ears heard things that it could not forget. He's wept your tears. You can know that you have a God who understands deeply and intimately your pain and your suffering because he has entered into it. He's not remained lofty and far from it. But more importantly, you don't just have a God who can sympathize and empathize with you in your pain, but you have a God who has done something to destroy evil at its root in these horrific events. You see, we have a God who has done something to deal with the evil in our hearts that needs to be dealt with. You see, the guilty must be punished. Evil must be destroyed if the world is to be made right again. But as we said earlier, the line between good and evil, it cuts through our hearts. We're part of the problem. And something has to be done about the problem that lies in our hearts. And at the cross of Jesus, all evil, all injustice stands under God's eternal no, under his condemnation. His word, it shall not be like this forever. I am coming to destroy it. But the cross of Jesus is not just God's eternal no against sin. It's also God's, it's also the place where the love of heaven meets the justice of heaven. Where God's Son is willing to stand in our place and to take on his shoulders all of our guilt, all of our shame, all of our wickedness and evil. Not just what we have suffered from others, but what we have also caused others to suffer. He takes it all upon his shoulders, and there on that cross, he suffers in our place the punishment that we deserve. The death that our sins deserve, Jesus has died. Jesus has died under the eternal no of God, his Father, in our place instead of us. And the story doesn't end there, because the story continues that 3 days later, Jesus rose again to life, announcing as he rose again from the grave, God's eternal yes. Yes, there is hope for the victims of injustice. Evil is coming to an end, and God's new world is coming. Yes, there is hope for people who have been hurt and violated by evil and injustice, because God is one day going to heal and to make us whole again. Yes, there is a Father in heaven who loves us, and who wants to bring us home. And he has sent Jesus, his Son, to bring us there and guide us there safely. Jesus' cross, his resurrection, it is a sign of God's no on our sin and God's yes to us as sinners. He wants to bring us home. So tonight, as we draw these thoughts to a close, I want to plead with you not to reject Jesus on the basis of bad experiences that you have had, of people who have acted in his name. I want to encourage you to look at Jesus for who he is, and I think you'll be astounded. He is amazing, he is wonderful, he is beautiful, he is a great friend, he is a great savior. I also want to ask you that as you look at church, to look at it in a new way, a different way. Church is not a place for people who have got it all sorted. Church is, in the words of someone else, a hospital for sick people. That's why it's so messy. Church is not a museum of saints, it is a hospital for sick people. And the good news is that Jesus has come to rescue messed up people. I know that describes me tonight. I'm a messed up person. I wonder, would you describe yourself as a messed up person this evening? Because if you do, Jesus is for you. And Jesus came for you. And Jesus wants to take you and return you to his Father and bring you home. So look to Jesus, take his hand, and follow him on the journey. That's what I would encourage you to do as you go through life in this world. Well, I think I've said enough. Phil, do you have any questions that have been texted in? Hopefully we have.
Just got a couple of questions for you here, Dave. Some have come in which maybe aren't strictly relevant to this topic, so I'll try and keep them relevant just given that we've got quite limited time. But firstly, if God knows we'll fail so often, why does he leave it to us to represent him? So I suppose if God knows we're going to be hypocrites, why does he let us loose?
That's a good question, isn't it? Yeah, that's a very good question. We often think that God could do a much better job if he was just to take this out of our hands, if he was to send the angels as messengers. The one problem of sending angels to bring to the world the good news about Jesus is that angels have no actual experience of it. Angels could be messengers. They could be like postmen. They could bring you a letter from God and say, right, this is the message. But the postman has no actual engagement with the contents of that letter, of that message. Instead, what Christians have been sent in the world to do is to be God's ambassadors, to be God's witnesses, to be able to say, let me tell you a story that has changed my life, that has made a difference to me personally. Let me tell you of how God has really worked. You see, Christianity is not just, like many of the other religions of the world, a lofty set of ideals and philosophies that if you just grasp your head around them and you work hard enough at them, then you can master them. Christianity is the story of what God has come and done in a different time, in a different place, that was a long time ago in a culture far, far away. And some people think, well, because we weren't there, we can't really trust it's true. We can't really know for sure. That's a different question. You can ask about that another time, perhaps. Come back for another ultimate question when we look at that. But I can stand before you and I can tell you that I'm someone whose life has been touched and been changed by the reality of Jesus Christ. The one who lived 2,000 years ago has changed my life now. I'm in a room of maybe 100 other people who could tell you that same story. And there are another 2 billion of them around the world today who name the name of Jesus and could tell you that he is real, and we know he's real because he's touched us. And so God in his wisdom says, that's better. I want walking, talking messengers who know in the deep place of their being that I'm real, that I have touched them. I think that's part of the answer to that question. Part of the answer, I'm going to say that.
For you. There are some good people in the world who don't believe in Jesus, but they still live like a Christian. Why can't God let them go to heaven as well?
Okay, good question. Now, just as we've said that religion and irreligion have their respective sets of badness that they can be held account for. What I'm not saying tonight is that you cannot be good without God, because we all know that there are good people in this world. At the very start, I quoted Gandhi. Gandhi was not a Christian at all. He said, I like Jesus, but I don't like your Christians. You maybe know of some of Gandhi's story, his work in India, returning from study overseas and seeking independence and seeking to peacefully overthrow colonial imperialism and oppression of his people. Gandhi did a lot of good. Whatever else you might think of him and have to say about him and your politics, about the British Empire and things, Gandhi did a lot of good. He wasn't a Christian. The list could go on. There are so many good people in this world who have done good things. The problem, if you are an atheist, is how do I justify my desire to do good in this world? You see, we live in a culture, a secular culture, that tells us in a big story that we have come from nothing, that this universe began 16 billion years ago in an explosion. It had no design, no purpose, no meaning. One day it's going to collapse and it's all going to end in nothingness. It tells us that we have evolved over millions of years through an unguided process of evolution that's purposeless again. It tells us that that process has been guided by the principle of the survival of the fittest and the perishing of the weak. And then it tells us that we who are at the climax of that process, that we should be kind and loving and generous to people. But how does that follow? There is no meaning or purpose, so that means there's no good or evil, ultimately. We have evolved from a process of violence and competition. But now we should all be egalitarian. We should be loving and generous to people. One Russian philosopher said, man evolved from apes, therefore we should love each other. He's making the point, it doesn't make sense. That doesn't follow one from the next. And so the question for good people in our society today is, I know that goodness matters. I know that justice is real and true. I know there's a thing such as beauty. And yet what I believe would deny that those things exist. It would tell me that it's actually an illusion. And that's a problem for the secular person today. That's a problem for secular humanism today. That's a problem for atheism. Not that I can't be good, but that I have no reason to be good. And I certainly have no reason to be evil and wicked, because there's no good or evil ultimately. A Christian has a better answer for that. It tells us that we have a creator. It tells us that there is such a thing as good and bad, because it reflects what God is like. He is good perfectly. He is just. He is beautiful. He made a world like that. And he calls us to live like that. That's the way he wants us to be. So that's part of the answer to the question. The second part of the question was about... give me the second part of the question again, Phil. The second part of the question was about why isn't doing good enough? And there are so many different ways that we could approach that, but perhaps just to take one. ultimately, the problem of that way of thinking about things, it's the problem of the second son in the story. He doesn't want to come into the heavenly party. He doesn't want to go there. That's not a place for him. If that's what God is like, if that's what my Father is like, if he is, welcomes people who don't deserve it, I want nothing to do with that. I want to go into, I want to be in a place where you get what you deserve. That's what I want. And so, so much of the problem, it's not that we don't do the right things enough to get into God's good books. The problem is that we actually don't want God himself. That we are alienated relationally from God. And where God is, we don't want to be, because we much prefer it in our own place. We much prefer it in the far off country. We much prefer it out in the field. We don't want to be in God's place, ultimately. Because we want to be the ones calling the shots. We want to be the ones who are kings and queens of our own lives. We want to be the ones who determine what's right and good and just for ourselves. We don't want to have to submit to God and say, actually, you know what's best. You're my good Father. I trust you. And so that's why it's never just as simple a solution as I'm going to do more good things. Because the problem is ultimately that it's your attitude towards God that's wrong. That you don't want to, you don't want God himself. That's what keeps you out of heaven. It's that you will not give him his place in your life. Sorry, that's a little bit confused, but hopefully there's something in there you can take.
Yeah, maybe we've probably got time for a couple more. I've got one more here, but if you want to fire any in, then it's not too late. I've lost it. One sec. Sorry. Okay. Sorry, Dave. How would you answer this question? Isn't religion just wishful thinking? You just believe it because it helps you get through life, but I don't need it.
Right? Yeah, good question. Different topic, but that's fine. All of us need a crutch in life. All of us need help in life. Christianity does help me in the midst of the brokenness of life. I have no shame in telling you that. It does help me. It is a crutch in one sense, but all of us have our crutches. The question is not, what does Christianity do for me? Because chocolate can do the same thing. For some people, chocolate's a good crutch. It helps you through the stressful, hard things in life. For other people, it's football or Netflix. There are lots of things in life that we turn to as our crutches. The question is not, what does Christianity do for me? Because lots of things could do that in different ways. The question is it true? I think that people who ask the question about wishful thinking want to avoid asking that question. Okay, what if it, regardless of how it makes me feel, regardless of how much it helps me, is it objectively true? Did it really happen? Did Jesus really live? Did he really say the things that he said? Did he make the claims that he did, claiming to be God? Did he do the miracles that are recorded of him? Did he die? Did he rise again? These are questions that, if they're true, regardless of if it does anything for us, we have to grapple with. C.S. Lewis once said that none of us can sit in the fence about Jesus. We all have to decide, was he mad? When he says, I'm God, is he mad? Is he a lunatic? Because if you were to go to a mental health hospital today, I'm sure you'd find some people who think that they're God of some sort, or even think that they're Jesus. Is Jesus mad? Is Jesus bad? Is he saying, I'm God, and then he knows that he's deceiving people? Or is Jesus God? Is he truly who he says he is? And if he is, then I have to grapple. There is nothing more important for me to grapple with than what he says about who I am, about what's wrong with me, and about how he can put me right again. That's not a subjective thing. It's ultimately a question about what is ultimately true. Did it really happen? And I think that you'll find that my subjective crutch, the help that I get from Jesus, it is based on objective reality of things that have happened, things which are true, things that stand up to the most vigorous scrutiny that you could throw against them. And so I have a crutch that really will help all the way through life's journey. That's what you'll find in Christianity. Not just chocolate, but Jesus Christ.
Thanks, Dave. One more question, which I think is a really good one and we should make time to answer. How do we explain to non-Christians that legalistic Christians are not biblical without making Christianity seem divided and unclear? So people might retort that, you know, the Crusades were a big Christian venture. Maybe that's one example of where they might see a bit of conflict.
Right. I think that it's always helpful today. I think that in our society, people hear Christian or hear religion and they immediately default to think it's legalism. It's a system where you have to do certain things to impress God and be acceptable to God. I think that's people's natural default understanding of things. And therefore, it's not enough that we have to point out that's not what Christianity is about. We've got to draw the contrast. And we've got good resources to do that from the Bible, because the stories in the Gospel, they tell us about people who lived life wild, and it tells us stories of people who lived life really good as well. And neither of them, like the story of the prodigal son, neither of them are right with God. Both of them needed Jesus. Both of them need to be brought home to the Father. And we need to make sure we tell the full story. It might be that when you're talking to someone who is from a very religious background, they've come to university and they have just left that all behind them. They have a bad taste in their mouth from their experiences. I've met many students who have gone through private school. They've been to chapel every single day. They have absolutely no time for Christianity or religion. They're done with that. It has been shoved down their throats so many times. And what they need help to see is that Christianity is not this thing with all this stuff that gets shoved down your throats. Christianity is about Jesus. It's about the Son, the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, the one who loves us and changes lives now and forever. It's about the story that makes sense of everything. And it shows us our place very clearly in this world and in the future. It's liberating, it's freeing, it's not controlling and condemning and constraining, as so many people think. And so we've got to tell the full story. I think so often our tradition, our stream of church, has been very much focused on the stories of the prodigal sons who have had their wild life and had their radical conversion and come back. I think we need to tell a lot more stories of the good boys and girls like me in Northern Ireland who grew up in church and didn't know anything different, and who in different ways have realized that that wasn't what it was all about. There we go. That's
great.
Shot.
Thanks, Dave. That marks the end of our questions. Thanks very much if you submitted a question. We're going to jump up now and just do one more song before we finish. But if you do have any more questions, then please don't go away without speaking to Dave and having them answered. So if you bear with me one sec, we'll get ourselves set up here and we'll stand together in a moment.